Yeah, and I'm not going to introduce myself in the third person, as I said, because that would just get really weird. But yeah, so I think I guess what I'm getting from these talks really is just that this whole theme of transformation and the obstacles that we face, you know, on the spiritual path. Well, just like that, there's quite a lot of energy behind them, if that makes sense. And yeah, I think a large reason there's a lot of energy behind them is just that often the things we find difficult often take up, you know, the most room in our minds, so to speak. I know my sort of own experience, you know, when I'm able to sort of transform a difficulty, that it does kind of feel like a weight has been lifted from me. I kind of got that sense in both Alex's and Isabel's talks, actually, that actually they were, you know, they'd moved into a place of sort of greater freedom through kind of looking directly at these, you know, particular obstacles, whether over a shorter or, you know, longer period that we might have to work with. And yeah, I think it's by doing this that we sort of, the reason we're giving these talks in a way, I think, is because it this is partly how we open up this mythical world of Padmasambhava, is by looking at these obstacles on the path. So yeah, in effect, that's kind of what I want to talk about as well. And I'm going to do that just by, I'm going to talk about internal obstacles, and I'm going to talk about external obstacles, particularly in terms of the external, in terms of societal conditions. Because I think, you know, we're almost certainly, and I've faced both. And on a sort of subtler point, I guess it can also be sometimes really useful just to notice whether there's any sort of interplay between these internal and these external obstacles that we face. So in terms of the internal obstacles, I wanted to start with a story, partly, you know, inspired by knowing that Vidyasaki was going to tell us a story. So it's not Padmasambhava, but Milarepa, who, in a way, he kind of comes a bit after Padmasambhava, but a very well-known Tibetan yogi and poet. And basically the gist is that he came back to his cave where he'd been meditating, and some demons had made themselves incredibly cozy in his cave. So it was like, you know, a real scene of domesticity, which, you know, just really bizarre kind of image in a way. And so Milarepa decides that he wants to try and get rid of these demons. And what he does is first he tries to use his sheer sort of spiritual might or force by conjuring up a wrathful Buddha in meditation, which doesn't work. They're still there. He then tries to show them his compassion. And unfortunately, again, they're unfazed by this, still snarling and baring their teeth at him and cooking their dinner, I think, something like that. And then finally, he tries to teach them the Dharma. But yeah, again, this doesn't work. And the problem is, and this is Sangharakshita sort of points this out, is that sort of Milarepa, when trying to remove these demons by sheer force or by teaching them the Dharma, he was, in a way, he was acting from this assumption and attitude that these demons did indeed need to be got rid of. So his attitude, even when trying to show them compassion, was one of some kind of aversion, in a way, and sort of resorting to sheer willpower. In a sense, basically trying to get rid of what he didn't want or think should be there in his cave. In a way, he didn't sort of recognize the appearance of these demons as an opportunity for spiritual transformation or as an opportunity to see how much he'd already transformed already. So by this point, Milarepa is like a very highly realized spiritual practitioner, and definitely one who didn't need to rely solely on willpower. And of course, in the story, he does finally see this, and with the help of his guru, he's able to subdue these demons. So, yeah, I think for me, on a sort of obviously on a bit of a lesser level, I do kind of relate to this story. Yeah, things that have seemed like obstacles have given me the opportunity to transform, and sometimes also revealed, you know, a treasure of perhaps, you know, I might have transformed more than I thought already. And perhaps the obstacle in a way being, sometimes being the fruit of spiritual practice. So, yeah, the personal example I want to give is just one I've sort of experienced more recently, which is basically experiencing anxiety. So, you know, something that a lot of us have kind of faced in one way or another. And for me, this started to come up a few months before I went away for 4 months to Gyaloka. And yeah, I just sort of started to experience it in a way I hadn't really sort of experienced before. Normally in situations where I felt like quite confident. So, you know, things at like work or, you know, doing the Young Buddhist Nights or just talking to like a friend or something like that. And yeah, fortunately for me, it was like kind of clear why it was like coming up to a certain degree. It was like, oh God, I'm going away for 4 months and being ordained. And it's like, okay, you know, that is a fair reason, like why I was like feeling a bit like, you know, stirred up, which was definitely helpful to a certain degree. But yeah, I think at first I did a bit like Milarepa. I did sort of kind of in a way just want to like, you know, get rid of it and like, you know, just either sort of ignore that. Or one of my other tactics was try not to put myself in situations where it might come up, which, you know, being at like work and just like general daily life definitely was not a tactic that did work. And in a way, what I sort of quickly realized was just that I needed to kind of sort of in a way just acknowledge, you know, what was going on. So it was like, okay, you know, I'm feeling this, you know, coming up, and oh yeah, I can just tell people that that's, you know, sort of coming up. So one of the first things I did was I told my boss at work, and I told, you know, some friends, and yeah, they were just, you know, very supportive of that. And interestingly, you know, the effect of sort of talking about it more openly, it wasn't that the anxiety sort of went away, which was kind of what part of me was hoping, right? I was like, oh, you know, maybe if I just talk about it, it will like kind of go away. I was like, oh, no, no, that isn't what happened. But yeah, in a way, it sort of, I mean, it both sort of helped me sort of just clarify what was going on a bit more fully, but also just meant I could come into sort of a bit more, you know, authentic communication. And yeah, I remember giving a talk, and I just felt like painfully sort of like anxious for like the whole talk. And yeah, I think the interesting thing about giving that talk was just that in a way I sort of felt anxious, but I also felt like a bit more confident, if that makes sense. It was kind of this weird sort of thing where I was both feeling anxious, but like somehow in better communication or more confident in the way I was communicating. And yeah, so really, I didn't sort of get what I expected by looking, you know, at this particular obstacle as I saw it. But yeah, in a way, you know, something quite different sort of came through. And also, you know, taught me a little bit more about what it, you know, what it means to work with obstacles like that. So I think to draw out kind of what I learned was, yeah, first of all, you know, if we have something like an internal obstacle come up, you know, the first thing we need to do is just sort of acknowledge and recognize it, which can be really hard. And then what we can do is we can try and shift our perspective, if possible, to sort of try and see this obstacle as an opportunity. You know, in my case, sort of allowing me to go into a bit more deep communication with people. And, you know, the opportunity may or may not become clear until we've tried to work with it. Or, you know, talked it over with other people and sort of got someone else's perspective on it, like a friend's perspective. And, yeah, the third thing was just sort of realizing, you know, how much influence over the situation did I actually have? It's like, okay, well, I'm definitely going to Gear Loco for 4 months, so I'm not going to not do that. So that's, you know, going to have certain, you know, repercussions. But what I could do was I could, you know, I could talk to people about it, and I could also just try and be aware of the feelings, you know, that were sort of like coming up in the body and go, okay, well, I'm feeling these things, like, all right, as much as possible, I'm going to try and like ground myself, you know, in the body and just, you know, pay attention to that. So, okay, this is how much influence I've got over the situation. But yeah, I think that's just a really good checklist to use. And it's not completely mine. I got part of it from Vajragupta's book, Sailing the Worldly Winds, which, yeah, I'd really recommend if you wanted to read a bit more about that. And so I want to move on to external obstacles. And I guess I'm primarily going to talk about the societal conditions, which I mentioned. So for us in the West, society sort of seems both, you know, set up positively for leading a spiritual life. You know, we've never had as much sort of leisure and freedom and material wealth as we have now. But also there's sort of quite often something under the surface, or even quite explicitly sometimes, which, you know, kind of goes against what we're trying to do. And that's, yeah, that's partly the reason I want to reflect on this as well. And when I was reflecting on this, there are a number of different things I could have talked about, but I think one of the main ones I've been working with has been individualism. And I'm going to give this might be a little bit dense, but hopefully stay with me. We can define, I've tried to define this worldview of individualism as the belief that we're essentially isolated individual agents, that our individual interests should take precedence over most other constraints on our freedom, and that we in the world would be best served by this. So the belief that we're essentially isolated individual agents, that our individual interests should take precedence over most other constraints on our freedom, and that we in the world would be best served by this. So yeah, I'm very strongly affected by that. And, you know, I think a large proportion of the world, you know, now is strongly affected by this. So Artur Priya asked me a good question. He asked me, okay, well, what is, what's wrong with this view? What sort of makes it an obstacle to transformation, potentially? And I think the main issue with individualism is that from a Buddhist perspective, it just doesn't accord with the way things really are, so with reality. And also that it's just a really incredibly limiting vision of human potential. And Buddhism says that, you know, we're not isolated individuals who are separate. You know, we're relational. And, you know, in a deep way, very interconnected with the rest of life. And what Buddhism says is that if I allow this view to be the one I act from, as underneath every action or non-action is a corresponding view, then it's going to cause myself and others to suffer in some way, because I'm not acting in accordance with the way things are, or with a vision of, you know, my own true potential, which is, you know, an interconnected being capable of transcending this view of a separate and fixed self. And yeah, I mean, that's quite dense. So I'm going to try and bring it down slightly. But I imagine most of us have tried to pursue what I'd call this, what I've termed this project of me. And I think we've all probably come along to Buddhism in some way, just because we've seen that that's, you know, that's not satisfactory, to some extent anyway. So Buddhism's saying that it's impossible to keep ourselves isolated from the world and sort of build up our own little world that meets all of our individual preferences. You know, reality is just going to come and break in and upset this project of me all the time. And sort of, you know, you could reference any of the worldly winds in this area. And what we're saying is that in order to truly transform ourselves and reveal a much more fulfilling vision than this project of me, we need to bring this view onto the path kind of with us. And yes, so the question is, how do we do that? So I guess, like with my first example, we need to firstly acknowledge and recognize our situation. And I really love the story in the Rajan Sutta as an example of this, where you've got King Pasenadi, who features in a number of the stories in the Pali Canon, and he asks his queen whether there is anyone dearer to her than herself. And she answers that no, you know, indeed there is no one who is dearer to her than herself. And she asks the question back to the king, and he says, well, no, yeah, I am the dearest person to myself. And I think the reason I just really love the story is just because it's so sort of unself-conscious in the way they just sort of admit that, you know, they are the most important people to themselves. And yeah, the king even goes up to the Buddha and sort of relates this to him. And the Buddha sort of, you know, is quite pleased with this. With this sort of recognition. And yeah, I think that's sort of where we need to come from, basically. Just acknowledging that we're conditioned by this view or any other view, you know, whether we've sort of consciously signed up to it or not. But then not sort of falling into the extreme of giving ourselves like a hard time for it, or of just actually just not addressing it at all. So we don't want to do either of those things. I think the next aspect of it is the opportunity. And I think the opportunity with looking at something like individualism is just sort of, for me, has been to discover sort of the richness and freedom of being part of a community or a sangha. And yeah, I think particularly... if I sort of reflected on this, it was particularly my experience of being at Gyaloka for 4 months. And I knew before I went out there that I had to sort of explicitly work with the tendency just to like not make it all about me, because I just knew that, oh God, you know, okay, I'm going to be in the mountains for like 4 months and things definitely aren't just going to be like the way I want them to be. So, you know, I know that I have a particular way of like looking at these kind of things. And yeah, I also kind of wanted just to try it as a bit of an experiment, really, to, you know, live a bit differently, or at least try to. So one of my practices from early on at the course at Gyaloka was slight, maybe a little bit perverse in some ways, but basically if... I had the thought or the voice in my head came up saying, I don't want to do that, and say it was like, I didn't want to clean up someone else's plate or offer to do Shibunaga's washing, then basically the practice would be to like do the thing that I didn't want to do, which, yeah, it was definitely a little bit difficult to get used to at first. But yeah, I think apart from the fact that the voice sort of came up less and less, and I'm not sure if that's just because my brain caught on to what was going on, which it might have done, but it did crop up less and less. And also, you know, I felt freer and sort of more in connection by sort of doing that practice. And yeah, in a way, what was happening is I sort of fundamentally sort of challenging this view of the project of me, and yeah, sort of challenging like this project of like what I do or don't want to do, you know, in quite a, like a fun kind of way. It was like, you know, a little bit perverse, but you know, equally it wasn't, you know, I wasn't sort of giving myself a hard time. And yeah, I did see that there was, you know, there was some freedom in that. And in a way, you know, I had to put that into practice and experience that in order for me to sort of know this. The important part was that it couldn't just sort of remain an idea, if that makes sense. So just to conclude, yeah, I think, you know, the practice of community and Sangha, you know, and it is a practice sometimes, is just a really good way of working with this view of individualism, you know, in a sort of constructive, positive way. And I was reflecting on the festival day and realizing that, you know, we're all kind of, in a way, by being here and engaging with the festival day, we're all sort of working with that particular view. I was saying to some worker, I think it might have been Art City, but with the festival day, it's like I look at the program and I go, immediately I'm start to think like which bits I do and don't want to go to. And it's like, you know, and immediately say, oh, right, okay, you know, what's going on here? It's like, you know, but it's so like immediate and quick to like come in. And part of that's okay. But, you know, I think as well, there is another way of sort of engaging with these kind of days, if that makes sense. That's one. But, you know, there is another sort of option of engaging. So, yeah, that's what I want to say. Thank you.